The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time. The following is a special presentation of Radio Memphis.
That's right. I promised you guys that we were going to have a very cool Radio Memphis weekend right here at radio-memphis.com. It's D. I know you're not used to me being on this early. I'm going to tell you what, man, little Mike's doing some funny stuff. But, I've got some very, very special things going on all day today. Now, you know that Radio Memphis Around the World officially kicks off at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. And, of course, we've got some cool interviews coming up for that. But I have somebody sitting here with me, and I had to make sure that I had the opportunity to actually talk with him, Mr. Bruce Sedano.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Listen, good morning.
Oh, good morning. You know what I'm going to do? Check that out. This mic is actually fucking, it's like messing up and stuff.
Get it right, girl.
I got to get it right, man. I'm normally not here this early in the morning.
Neither am I. Well, let's see. Maybe neither of us are really here yet.
You know?
Let's see.
At about 11 o'clock, we're both going to show up, and then yeah. You guys are going to hear what we went to hear. You're in town, and, you know, it was so funny because we had the opportunity to talk with your management team, and I knew that you were going to be in to do a show, Johnny Swim, you know. Your daughter's in that deal. You guys had a fantastic time here in Memphis last night.
Yes, we did.
At Minglewood Hall. You're also here in town today because you are doing a master songwriting class.
I am.
And so,
which is going to be interesting.
It should be. It should be very interesting. And I tell you, I was coming across some of the stuff, and actually one of my girls is going to be going to your class later on this afternoon. And, you know, when I saw it, I was like, well, he's going to be here, you know. And I just sat there and I thought to myself, you know, and of course, you know, Bruce and I have gotten acquainted with each other a little bit right before we got on air. And so you kind of know what we do here at Radio Memphis.
Yes.
And the fact that we've got the Unsigned and Indies and stuff. And I thought, you know, I need you in here because of who you are and because of all the incredible things.
Who am I?
Who are you? Who are you? You're just like this really cool dude that was part of some really cool soundtracks that I know that I danced my ass off to early on.
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. Who am I? You know, that's the interesting thing is that, you know, as you live life, you just keep, you know, figuring stuff out.
You do.
Sometimes you even have to relearn things, you know.
You do. You know, I sat there and for those of you who are tuned in, I'm talking to Mr. Bruce Sedano, singer-songwriter. You know, here's a cat who's done some really cool stuff. You've actually penned some things for people like, oh, I don't know, Michael Jackson, Dolly Parton, Reba McEntire. The list keeps going on, Jermaine Jackson, and of course, the lovely and most evanescent, you know, beautiful, beautiful late Donna Summer. And,
yes, ma'am.
And your wife.
Yes.
You've done, in a matter of all of your years, some incredible stuff. And you've seen so many cool things. And so, you know, I'd gotten permission not only to do the special broadcast and interview because I knew you're going to be in town. You know, it was one of those things where, look, I got him for X amount of time. Man, I get to hold commercials and everything for this one. So I get to sit and visit with you and we get
That's
to go over some music with you. I look at you. I have so much I want to ask you, and I'm like, man, I don't even know where to start.
Just start.
We have started, and I get that. How? How did you start? How did you get started?
I got started. It's all my grandfather's fault.
Oh.
Because my grandfather, when I was 4 years old, made a trip to Italy. Back to his town in Italy to visit, and returned to Brooklyn, where I was born and growing up, with an accordion.
Wow!
And because my grandfather brought this accordion with him all the way back from Italy for me, I was obliged to take accordion lessons.
You know, this is the second time. Look, in history of this station, you know, I had an artist of the month, you know, last month, you know, who wound up, he got his start, you know, with accordion. And I thought, okay, this will never happen again. And I'm sitting here with you.
Yeah. And here it is happening again.
It's happening again, an accordion.
Well, you know, it's interesting. And I'm sure, you know, it's not an uncommon story for guys of my generation.
Okay.
Because I guess the accordion was the thing back in the 50s. I don't know.
It was a sexy piece of machinery.
You know, funny thing is I've never considered it that.
I was trying to make it sound really good.
You did, but So that's basically how I got started. I was obliged to take accordion lessons, and I was even reluctant to do it because, you know, all my friends were outside playing stickball and football and all that stuff.
And so you're stuck inside with the accordion.
You know, and my mother forced me to practice. But, you know, really how it started was my parents took me to the Brooklyn Fox. And in those days, there were shows at the Brooklyn Paramount and the Brooklyn Fox, and there were multiple acts on the shows. So I got to see, you know, the last remnants of doo-wop, the Impalas.
Wow.
You know, I don't know why I even said that group, but all these groups. And so as a 9-year-old, I think I was 8 or 9 the first time I went, I started seeing all these acts performing on stage, and it just lit a fire in me. And it was like I had the blessing of knowing at a very early age what it is I wanted to do.
Yes, you did.
And I never really even considered myself very talented. It was something that it was really a desire of my heart, and I just pursued, you know, and believed.
Wow.
And showed up.
There it is.
You know,
you said it, and you showed up.
And I showed up.
And you showed up.
And you know, the showing up is a big part of what happens. And if you show up, things can happen, because you never know what door opens or how it's going to happen or where it's coming from, you know.
So how do you get past the accordion?
You get past the accordion because like all kids, you know, you're singing in a brush, into a brush, looking in a mirror.
Yeah.
And so then I started putting bands together as a teenager.
Okay.
And everybody talks about garage bands, and but in Brooklyn we were basement bands.
That's the same difference, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So that's why I'm very at home right here.
I was gonna say you must be very
home.
You
know, very at home. So started putting bands together and playing at clubs, and so I spent a good part of my life playing clubs in Brooklyn.
Wow.
And
so you started doing some stuff, but now look, at some point in time, you wind up gathering, some specific individuals, and you guys wind up, loading up in the vehicle and deciding, to go to, California. At what point in your mind is this a good idea?
Well, okay, I'll take a step back. The whole time I was in high school and college, I was playing clubs. The whole time I was in college, we worked our way up to where we were playing clubs in Manhattan.
Oh, wow.
And I had formed this band called Alive and Kickin'.
Yep.
And we're playing at a club on 52nd Street and 8th Avenue called the Cheetah. And one night we're playing, and through mutual whatever, a guy named Tommy James shows up. Tommy James, at that time, I'm talking 1968, was one of the biggest pop stars in America.
Wow.
He had a band called Tommy James and the Shondells, had
yes.
songs like Money Money and Hanky Panky, and
yes.
I Think We're Alone Now. And he shows up, sees the band, and he basically lives around the corner. And so, I strike up this, my whole desire really was always to be a songwriter.
Okay.
Because the thing about being in Brooklyn was that Manhattan was right over the bridge. So it allowed me to dream and to believe that, all things were possible if I could make it over the bridge. So I pursued Tommy, and he was gracious enough to say, okay, I'll co-write with you.
Wow.
And here I was as a teenager, and he was, basically the superstar of the moment then.
Well, sure.
So I would, on breaks from playing my gig at the Cheetah, would walk around the corner and go to his apartment on 8th Avenue and 54th Street.
And the fact that you remember these streets is great.
Yeah, well, they're embedded in my brain. I don't remember much, but, certain things I remember, that I remember. And we ended up co-writing a song, with Woody Wilson, who was the bass player in my band Alive and Kickin', called Ball of Fire.
Okay.
And this became a top 10 record for Tommy James and the Shondells in 1969. And what I like to say is, you know, I was a co-writer on that song, and what I wrote was of, you know.
But you had a piece.
But I had a piece, and I was in the room.
You were in the room.
And you know, and he was a very gracious guy and remains a gracious guy. And so subsequently, he agrees to produce my band.
Oh, wow.
And so we get signed to Roulette Records, which is an infamous record label back. I can't even talk. It's too early. An infamous record label back in the day.
Yeah.
Run by an infamous music business guy whose name was Morris Levy.
Oh wow.
So we were told at that time. Tommy then had a big hit record called Crimson and Clover, and on the Crimson and Clover album there was a song called Crystal Blue Persuasion. And so we were told that Tommy was going to produce this song, Crystal Blue Persuasion, for my band Alive and Kickin'. So we were excited, and we were in our basement rehearsing this song.
Well,
and,
sure.
You know, this was our first big chance to get into a recording studio. Because in those days, it wasn't like today.
No.
You didn't have the ability to record on anything. There was no way to record. And the ability to get in a studio was really difficult because it cost money, and, you know, who had money?
Right.
And so the fact that we were going to make a record, this was like an amazing thing. So, but then an interesting thing happened. Morris Levy decided that Crystal Blue Persuasion was going to be Tommy James' follow-up single.
Okay.
And so we couldn't record the song, and we were really disappointed. Months went by, but Morris Levy said to me, "Don't worry, kid. I'll have him write you another one." And
just like that.
Just like that, you know. And
I mean, Morris really liked you guys as a band and liked you guys as far as what you had going on, though, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were a good band, So months go by, and finally Tommy comes up with this song called Tighter, Tighter. And we go in to record it, and it becomes a top 10 single.
Wow.
At that point, you know, Bruce is like 19 or 20 and becomes the biggest, can you say asshole on this station?
You can.
Bruce becomes the biggest asshole in the world.
Did you?
You know, here he is. He gets out of school. He co-writes a song that's...
Third person thing, man. This is awesome.
You know, not only awesome, like, I got this shit down. This is easy. You know, now my band has a top 10 record. We're on American Bandstand. We're touring the country. We're...
Your head is... It's a whirlwind.
You know, and I think this is easy. And then, so then... Now, if you listen to the first Alive, the only Alive and Kickin' album, I think there were 9 or 10 songs on that record. The one that was the hit that Tommy James wrote, and the 9 others that Bruce wrote with the guys in the band.
Okay.
That are, when I listen to it now, I obviously had no idea what I was doing. I mean,
the fact that you can come around and say that now.
Well, I mean, it's part of the evolution of somebody who has a desire to be a songwriter.
Sure.
But is really starting out and finding his way. So I was writing about all these things. I was a kid that was, you know, born and grew up in Brooklyn who basically had never been out of the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, and the songs on the Alive and Kickin' album were like Kentucky Fire, mm-hmm. and Junction Creek and Mississippi Mud. And I mean, like...
How would you know?
I had no idea.
How would you know?
And they were all like 7 minutes long. You know, so subsequently, you know, I started, you know, firing everybody in the band and you know, I just... But the upshot was, so this was 1970. By 1970, I had gotten a penthouse apartment, you know, in Brooklyn, but by 1972, I was back living in my mother's basement.
Ah, so it always comes back to the basement.
Back to the basement. And there I was in the basement, you know, in Alive and Kicking. I was the Hammond B3 player.
Oh, nice. We have one right there.
Yeah, I saw it. That. Yeah. You know, which was, you know, the evolution of the guy who started on the accordion.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there I was back in the basement and completely disillusioned, but I had learned a great lesson. So basically, for the next couple, the next year and a half, I lived in the basement and
I love it.
Taught myself to play the guitar.
Okay.
And wrote a lot of songs.
Okay.
And listened a lot. You know,
I love the way, and for those of you who have tuned in, you know, I'm sitting here with the most wonderful and the coolest dude on the planet, you know, Bruce Sedano. What I love the way you say, you know, songwriter, you say it in a separate sense than you say as performer or musician, you know, and there's a very specific defining line when you make that statement, you know, and there's something very cool. I don't know what it is. It's real warm and fuzzy for me when you do that.
Oh, well. I mean, well, you know, songwriting is my heart. That's the thing that when I get up every day and I, you know, and I'm dealing with the realities of life and all these things, that's the place that I go to where I'm free,
nice.
You know, and where I'm home. And you know, that's just a beautiful gift, you know, that I have that place to go to. And, you know, so, you know, the performing and the singing and all that stuff, I love it. But, you know, the songwriting is my home, and it's also the hardest work because that's the place where you have to go to and really examine what you're trying to say, what you feel about that, and work. And you know, because the performing is just like, you know, the song is written, you know the words, you know the chords, you just get up there and, like, you know, do it, you know, So that's fun once, you know, like, you get beyond your nerves, which is something that I always have to deal with. But you know, so anyway, blah.
Blah. Well, I'll tell you what. Well, I want to play one of your songs first.
Cool.
And then we're going to come back because I want to know what happens after you get out of the basement.
There you go.
I got some cool stuff. Now, 21st Century, all right?
Yeah.
It's coming out May 5th, all right? And we actually have some tracks, you know, from that album and stuff. And it's come out with critical acclaim. Everybody is, you know, everybody knows that you've got a message and you're trying, and you're yanking the attention of everybody to pay attention to life.
That's what I'm trying to do. Get people to listen, start a conversation, and let's talk about these things because we're in a very interesting time of the world right now.
And you would know. I'll tell you what. It ain't cool. We're going to talk about it next right here only on Radio Memphis.
You are a part of a Radio Memphis weekend. Special shows, live performances, and the best indie music in the world. We are
Radio Memphis. I've got, you know, cut Joel off right there. You guys are tuned in. This is me, D, hanging out with Mr. Bruce Sedano. You just heard It Ain't Cool off a 21st Century World. And I'm going to tell you what, I don't know about the title, but that song is cool.
That song
is very cool. That's very cool. It's some good stuff right there. Off the new album, due out May 5th. And now we during the break, actually while the song was playing, you were telling me about who produced it and why.
Yes. This song was the whole record was produced by Mike Montali, who's the lead singer and songwriter for a great young rock band called Hollis Brown.
Okay.
We toured together last fall in Europe, and we bonded, you know, as people and as musicians. And when I was getting ready to do these records, I had, you know, what I started doing is I started sending Mike the songs as I was writing them. And we, you know, we would talk about it. And, you know, we have that kind of relationship now where he sends me stuff that he's working on and back and forth. So because I wanted this record to be more urgent and more stripped down. And because I've been doing it for so long, you know, as you know, you develop habits of, you know, how you do things, how you get your bass sound, and what harmonies you hear, and all kind, you know, and all these things. So I wanted a younger, different take on what I was doing. So I asked Mike if he would produce the record, and he was like, really? I'm not a producer. I'm like, well, you know, and we would talk about, you know, and I would say, how do you hear this?
Right.
And, you know, and he would say, well, you know, I kind of hear you. This is how, you know, and because I toured with him, he had a really good sense of who I am as an artist, you know, and, you know, I've really only been doing Bruce Sudano, the artist, in this way for only a few years.
And a lot of people don't realize that.
You know, I mean, I've been in the music business a long time, but I'm essentially this old guy who's a new artist.
Right.
Which is really fun because I'm very engaged. I'm very inspired. And I'm fully alive. So it's also a challenge. And in life, you need to consistently challenge yourself. That's what keeps you going. So Mike produced this record. He did a great job and blah.
Well, he did a fantastic job. So this brings me back around to how did we get out of the basement?
Okay, so that story all began. You asked me how I got to California.
Right.
So at some point, you know, I'm in the basement, and I make an initial trip to L.A. in 1973. I had this girlfriend of one of my good friends. They broke up. And I concocted this plan with her where, you know, she had a 1963 Pontiac Le Mans.
Oh, nice.
And, so I packed a bag and an acoustic guitar. I got in the car with her, and we drove across the country. And along the way, you know, we blew a carburetor, and, you know, we got snowed in New Mexico and ended up living in New Mexico for a few weeks and made it out to L.A., made some friends, got a job as a busboy and a waiter, and subsequently a waiter in a couple of different restaurants. Was out there for about a year.
Sounds like a movie.
And then ran out of money, my parents sent me a ticket to fly back to New York.
Okay.
So there I am back in the basement again. It's 1974.
What's your family saying to you during this entire time?
They're saying, go, Bruce.
Are they really?
Yeah. Like they
even during the time period when Bruce thought that he was like top of the hill and was mean and a jerk and stuff?
Well, they always encouraged me and, you know, and said, you know, follow your dreams. My parents were dreamers, you know, and they believed in my talent, which was, you know, something that I, you know, always didn't, but I was passionate. So there I am. I'm back in the basement. I had friends who were back in the clubs, playing in the clubs.
Okay.
As a favor, almost. They were like, okay, let's take Bruce in the band. So there I was back playing the clubs in Brooklyn six nights a week with these guys. Two of them, Joe Esposito and Eddie Hoganson, in May of 1966, get in a Volkswagen. They take the passenger seat out of the Volkswagen. So one of them drives and one of them sleeps while the other one is driving, and they head back out to L.A.
Okay.
Eddie Hoganson is maybe the funniest guy in the world because here's the joke of that trip. So, you know, they're supposed to do like shifts driving.
Of course.
So one drives, one sleeps.
Of course.
Joe drives, Eddie sleeps. Eddie gets behind the wheel. Joe goes to sleep. Eddie drives for a couple hours, moves the clock ahead, wakes Joe up, says it's your turn again, goes back to sleep. So, but anyway, they make it to L.A.
They never figure out that that's what he was doing.
I'm now back in Brooklyn, and no band. I am now selling orange juice on the beach.
Stop it.
So
that's an actual job?
Well, I created this
job.
Okay. And I had a shopping bag. I would fill it with dry ice, go to the grocery store, get, you know, like these little containers of Tropicana orange juice. And I'm walking around the beach hitting every blanket. You need some orange juice? You know.
Oh, how funny.
But then one night I'm walking home from my girlfriend's house. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning. I get held up by three kids at gunpoint.
You're kidding.
And so basically on July 4th, 1976, I go back to L.A. and hook up with Joe and Eddie, and we formed the Brooklyn Dreams. I had all these songs that I had written in the basement, and they became the foundational songs of the first Brooklyn Dreams album.
Okay.
I got an apartment on Laurel Avenue in Sunset in West Hollywood. We would rehearse in my apartment. It was a one-room apartment with I had a little upright piano, a bed, and a refrigerator in the one room. We would rehearse there.
Nice.
That's how Brooklyn Dreams were formed.
Brooklyn Dreams comes out swinging and stuff like that. And so,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
for you to get up and leave, you know, New York again after, you know, such a crazy moment. I mean, that moment, you know, on July 4th, was that the, like, hey, that's it, I'm done, I'm leaving here, I'm not doing this.
I mean, you know, I'm a big believer in life in reading the signs.
Ah.
So, you know, I was probably should have left with Joe and Eddie in May, but I decided to stay. And, then this happened in July, and I was like, okay, Bruce, you know, it's a big enough song. You're out of here.
Get out.
Leave now. Yeah.
So you guys wind up, you get the foundations for Brooklyn Dreams, and you really start rocking it out. Millennium Records shows up.
Yeah. Millennium Records shows up. You know, we always said that, you know, I mean, along the way, we had done crazy things. I mean, we took, you know, all our gear on a subway one day and went up to Arista Records and basically broke into Clive Davis' offices and started singing. So we really tried to get signed in New York, and we couldn't. Clive was like, boys, this is not the way you do this. You know, so, you know, security came, they escorted us out of the... Now we're in L.A. and basically doing the same thing, you know, different bunch of songs. But it was a different dynamic because, you know, L.A. was all about, you know, this L.A. kind of sound and this laid-back sound. And, you know, so here we were, these three guys with, you know... an R&B rock kind of feel, and it was a different thing. You know, we hooked up with Bobby Womack. He has a singing background on his records and things like that, and so we started to create a buzz around in L.A. And we did a demo, which was produced by a guy named Snuffy Walden. And if you don't know Snuffy Walden, you should. I mean, he basically is the guy who did all the music for the Wonder Years. And,
cool.
You know, I don't know what TV shows he's doing now, but he's a great Texas blues guitarist.
Wow.
Produced our first demo, and we got signed to Millennium.
Yes.
Jimmy Einer signed us to Millennium Records. So anybody thinks that it's a quick little road from point A to point B?
No,
because it's more of a saga.
You've done everything, you know, between selling orange juice on the beach, you know, to getting held up, you know, to getting stuck in the basement three or four different times, you know, and it all started with an accordion.
Yeah.
And I just started
with an accordion and a dream.
I'm trying to absorb this. Yeah. Now, one of the things now with you guys and I noticed Millennium Records actually was distributed by Casablanca,
yes.
And the cool thing, and I don't know if you've noticed this, the way things are now, everybody thinks it's like this really new stuff. Okay, there's nothing new. Okay,
right.
Everything kind of repeats itself.
Well, it's biblical. It says there's nothing new under the sun.
There it is. You guys heard it from Bruce DeSedano right here on Radio Memphis. So there was a time point where. Casablanca and actual Millennium, you know, artists would start collaborating. Hence, how you were able to actually meet Donna.
Well, yes and no.
Yes and no. Okay,
yes.
And that's okay. I want the word.
So,
give me the good word, brother.
Here's the word.
Okay.
So Millennium signs us and says, "Okay, you're coming back to New York to record."
You mean I'm going to the basement again?
So we're like, okay, you know, we got an advance. We got apartments. Mm-hmm. And now we're going back to New York. We have to give up our apartments. We give up our apartments. And they go, no, no, there's been a change. You're going to record in Los Angeles. We're like, oh, we have no place to live. So we call our friend Susan Mineo. Susan Mineo was a girl that grew up in our neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Okay.
She was the one girl that we knew that wanted to be in the music business. So she was the one girl that had a job in the city that would come home back to Brooklyn and bring Billboard magazine with her. Oh. And she, so, and we would like hit her up. Can we read Billboard magazine?
Right.
So she was the publicity girl at Casablanca Records.
Oh, so she winds up making her way through as far as what she plans. Okay. Yeah.
And so we now call Susan. Susan, we have nowhere to live. We just gave up our apartments. Can we come and stay with you for a few days? Because the record company was going to get us apartments out in Irvine, California, mm-hmm. where we were going to record. Mm-hmm. So we go to Susan's house. We're sleeping on the floor. Mm-hmm. And one Sunday afternoon, this girl, Donna Summer, who had just recently had a big record with a song called Love to Love You, Baby, comes to visit her publicity agent. Because she was getting a driving lesson drove over to the house with whoever this person was that was giving her the driving lesson. She had just got her driver's license.
Okay.
And this is how I met Donna.
Oh, wow.
It was March 13th, 1977.
Oh, I remember the day completely.
Yeah.
So when you saw her, what was going through her head?
We're like, hey, let's write a song.
Right when you saw her.
Yeah, the three of us sat at a table. We took
Is that how that works?
Well, that's how it worked there.
Okay.
We took out our guitars, and we started writing songs. And we probably wrote three or four songs that first session. We were just...
Really?
We were just flowing.
Well, see, that just blew my whole thesis out of my head on how this really went down.
Really? What was your thesis?
Well, I mean, I was sort of really thinking that, okay, you know, that they wound up, you know, kind of getting thrown together, you know, because of the relationship between Millennium and Casablanca. And, and not to say that artists, you know, that they, at those time periods, and now, because it looks like that's what they're doing now, we're collaborating, you know, and actually, you know, trying to make some new things. And I'm thinking, oh, well, how cool. I mean, that was almost kind of, you know, fortuitous and, it would meet up. And no, your story is much better.
Yeah. No, it had nothing to do with the labels.
I love it. It had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Awesome. You know, and you know, for me, I've never really been good about... you know, being set up in a writing situation. I'm always uncomfortable in those kind of things. But when things kind of generically happen, and you know, that's always the best way for it to work. And so that's what happened. And basically, Donna and I hit it off instantly. You know, we basically stayed up for like the next week. You know, writing and writing and playing and that was really how I got to know her.
Oh wow!
Well,
she got to know you through the one thing that got to, you know, that gets to your, you know, your inner soul is your songwriting.
Yeah, exactly.
And she got in.
Yeah, but the relationship really couldn't start then because you know she had a boyfriend and I had a girlfriend. So we kind of had this little tap dance that was going on for a while, you know.
And you felt that instantly in the very beginning.
It was instant. Yeah, we were. You know, I think the fact that we stayed up for days writing mm-hmm. had more to do with.
And you forgot that you had significant others when that moment happened.
Yeah. My girlfriend was in Brooklyn. Her boyfriend Donna had lived in Germany for 8 years. Because she had gone over to do the show Hair.
Oh, wow.
So at 19 years old, she moved to Germany and lived there for 8 years.
Oh, wow.
And she had just come back to the States when we met.
Imagine that.
And
there's her sign.
Yeah, there you go.
There's your sign. there's your sign. That's insane. So you guys wind up, you know, as far as doing, you know, the tap dance, you know, and everything else. And I have to say, in this business, okay, you know, for a couple to have stayed married, you know, for 30 plus years, you know, insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Well, you know, part of, you know, when I've been doing these shows now, and I've been doing songs from this, from the new record, and there's a song on the record called When Cinderella Dies. Mm. And, you know, now that, you know, I'm a single guy back out in the world again, you know, I've been meeting all these single mothers.
Wow.
You know, and I started to realize that there's an epidemic of single motherhood, and that there's a crisis in marriage. You know, so part of my rap before I go into this song is to really, you know, not to indict anybody that's divorced or anything like that.
Well,
because,
sure,
you know, life happens and marriage is hard.
It is.
You know, but just as a point of encouragement to, you know, people who are married and maybe having a rough time in their marriage, or all these kids who are about to get married,
right,
to say to them, like, you know, you can do it. It can be done, you know,
right,
and it's not easy. But if you get over the bumps and get through those valleys, mm-hmm, it smooths out again, and your love gets deeper and bigger, and it changes over time, and that's okay. It's supposed to.
It's
not always, you know, sunshine and roses. You know, it's not. That's not the way life is.
Right.
But it's important when you make a commitment, you know, and you
I'm
make
so
that
glad
covenant,
you're saying that,
you know,
too.
So
I'm so,
anyway,
glad, you're, I'm so,
you know,
glad you're saying that. I come from, you know, I come from a family, you know, my parents will be celebrating their 50th this year.
Oh, awesome.
And I've got an older sister who has been married for over 32 years. I've got a brother who's been married for over 22 something years. And so, you know, for me, I mean,
unique, man. That's a unique story.
It is. And you know, and it's funny because, I lose hope and faith,
yeah,
and I hate,
yeah,
saying it like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
That people don't understand.
Yeah.
When you say for better, for worse.
Yeah.
You know, for
richer, right,
for poorer.
Yeah.
I mean, you mean it.
Yeah.
You mean it. You know, and that's you know.
Yeah, it's important. You
it
know,
is.
So I mean, so that's really part of my message now. I mean,
sure.
I. You know, I think that, and the interesting thing as I'm doing these shows, the kids in the audience. When I'm saying that, instead of, you know, I didn't know how it would be taken.
Sure.
You know, because I don't want it to come off, you know, like I'm the old guy preaching, you know.
Right.
You know.
You're still hip. You're still cool.
Well,
you look great.
You know,
I mean, look, dude, you look great. You look younger than me.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. But but you know, the response is they start applauding.
Nice.
And so it's encouraging, and I just want to get that word out. So
You need to get that word out. Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we play that song?
Cool.
We'll play that song, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk some more, man, because I got to pick your brain a little bit more before you get out of here from me.
All right, man.
All right. I'm talking with Bruce Sudano right here on Radio Memphis, and this is off 21st Century World When Cinderella Dies right here only on Radio Memphis. Sudana for you right here on Radio Memphis for the special broadcast brought to you by Radio Memphis and Radio Memphis Around the World. That is off the 21st Century World album, When Cinderella Dies. And I got Mr. Bruce sitting here with me right now. And, you know, when we were talking just now, I want to tell you something. And, of course, you put it in perspective for me. I'm one of those people that always tells people, like, don't date the bass player.
Yes.
I will stick firm, because I will sit there and look at you in the eye and go, it's a bad idea, and if you do this, it's going to ruin all creativity, and it's going to go bad, and your relationship's going to fall apart, and it's going to get nasty, and people are going to look at you like you're an idiot, and don't do it. I have a confession. I was one of those people, okay?
Yeah.
Until I'm sitting here in front of you, and you know, and you discussed, you know, about your relationship with Donna Summer, and of course you were telling me about how people in the very beginning you guys decided that you're going to get into this relationship,
yeah,
and that, you know, and we're talking, and see, the thing about it with you And not to make it any different, you know, marriage and relationship is just that, marriage and relationship. I mean, it's whether, you know, whether you own a restaurant, whether you're a musician, you know, whether you're an entrepreneur, business-wise,
that's
or whatever.
Right.
There's so many, you know, different elements.
That's right.
You know, in our world, music business, you know, since we're sitting here in the station and stuff, I figure we'll talk it in that ramp. There's so much that gets thrown in the mix that can make it very easy for everybody to be deluded and everybody to kind of, you know, get off the track of what's,
yeah,
what's there. And so,
yes,
in the beginning for you and for and Donna, everybody was coming at you like, bad idea.
Bad idea. You're ruining your career by making this move. And, you know, also, as I said, at that time, you know, we were an interracial couple. It wasn't the norm back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was all those pressures. But the thing was, and this is what I always said to my kids, is that, look, it's about the choices that you make, and you want to have a successful life. It's not only about a successful career, you know, so you have to have your priorities in order. Right. You want a successful life. So this is what the goal is. So, you know, at some point in time when our kids were born, we left Hollywood. And there again, they were saying to us, you guys are ruining your career by leaving Hollywood now. And in some ways, there were sacrifices that we made. I mean, there were certainly career opportunities that were missed for me, but especially for Donna.
Wow.
That because she would say, no, my kids need me now.
Wow.
So I'm not going to do this. And
that was a big thing. I mean, because, you know, you got to sit there and think. I mean, okay, so you guys wind up getting together, you know, and of course, you know, this is, you know, Brooklyn Dreams, you know, winds up actually, you know, coming in and supporting her on some stuff. But then you yourself, you step aside and you wind up, you know, obviously being, you know, a main songwriter and stuff, you know, as far as in her world and her life. And you kind of take the shift and, you know, kind of like the musical director, you know,
yeah,
world, you know, as far as of her idea.
You know, at some point, when my daughter Brooklyn was born, it was 1981.
Nice.
And Brooklyn, by the way, is stars on a TV show now on NBC.
Yes, she does.
Called Taken. Check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, a little shameless plug.
Noted.
But in 1980, I did Brooklyn Dreams broke up, and I did the first Bruce Sudano solo album.
Right.
And but at that point, I realized that I could not maintain my solo career, Donna's career, be a father, and do all three of those things well. It couldn't work.
Wow.
So I made the choice to stop being the solo guy, because initially my dream was always to be a songwriter. So the artist performer thing wasn't my priority. My priority was to be a songwriter, and I could still be a songwriter, and I went on to write songs for lots of people
and movies.
And I still got to jump around on stage singing background with Donna, and so that, you know, part of my psyche was filled as well.
Oh, wow.
And so that's that story. So anyway,
so you're doing all of this stuff, and you wind up, like I said, you know, pretty much, you know, becoming the songwriter, becoming, you know, the director, if you will, and background and stuff as far as for Donna. How is it that you wind up, people start searching you out to write songs for them? Because you did one real cool song for Michael and Jermaine on Jermaine Jackson's album. You wind up doing stuff for Reba McEntire, Dolly Parton, and the beautiful thing about it is that you're not, you know, this is when you know that it's right, when it's not a genre specific thing, when you can,
yeah,
write something and it can fit whomever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did these opportunities start coming down?
Well, you know, nobody ever searched me out. You know, it was, you know, most things happen by accident.
Oh, wow.
And it's kind of goes back to what I said earlier about showing up and relationship.
Nice.
And allowing things to evolve in a natural way. Now, look, this is the way it happened for me. It's not the only way. I'm not saying that it can't happen any other way, because there's lots of ways. Everybody has their own road. It's a matter of understanding who you are and what your road is and walking your own road.
Nice.
And you know, the 80s were even though I had success as a songwriter in the 80s, it was also a very difficult time for me as a songwriter because I was still hungry to succeed. And that...
What's your definition of success?
I don't know because, you know...
And that's the best...
You know, the thing is, you know... You know, well, you know, there is no there. You know,
it's
you know, so it's always, you know, you're always on the journey and you're always on the path. So that fire to succeed is always there. But I think for me at that point in my life, as a younger guy who had kids and a family and a, you know, I was here. I was in this environment of everybody that was super successful.
Wow.
You know, my best friends were David Foster and Quincy Jones.
Wow.
And my wife was Donna Summer. So here I am in this realm
right.
of success.
Right.
So, you know, if I get a song in a movie, it's great. But I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not these people. You know, so, you know, I always had this mentality of, you know, I have, you know, mountains to climb. And as a result of that, and this is a songwriter tip that I'm getting to, as a result of that, I was chasing it. And so, you know, I had some really good songs that I wrote in the 80s, you know, a few, you know.
A couple.
But I wrote lots of songs that were really, you know, some of my worst songwriting. Because I was trying to chase the trend and trying to do things that weren't my strength.
Wow.
You know, so it was a lesson that I had to learn. Because like a song like Starting Over Again is a Bruce song.
Wow.
You know, in that the songs that I write are about real life issues, about things that, you know, move me. You know, when I try and write a clever pop song, not my strength.
No.
You know, so
I wouldn't even have thought that.
Well, yeah,
that's funny.
But you know, it's the truth, and it's not to say that I didn't get better at it because there is the craft of songwriting, and you know you learn as you go, and you learn this trick, and you learn that, and you learn what to do and what not to do. So you know. You know, it wasn't, I won't say that I wrote bad songs because, you know, I was at a level where just craft-wise, I was able to write a good song. I mean, it was, you know, but, you know, it wasn't really true to who I am and what my strengths are. So, you know, that's the other songwriting tip is, you know, understand what your strengths are and develop, you know, work on your weaknesses,
right.
but go with your strength.
And go with your strength and
yeah.
stuff. You know, the funny thing with you, you know, Bruce, is these incredible people that are your best friends and your wife and everybody, they probably thought you were just amazing already.
Well, I don't know what they thought, but you know, but this is what I thought.
Well,
we all live inside our own heads.
We
you
do,
know?
And you've taught me a very, very, very valuable lesson, and you had no idea, you know, and it was kind of I understood what you meant, you know, as far as about, you know, it's of course, I call it chasing the tail,
yeah.
you know what I mean?
Because yeah.
ultimately
yes.
that's what
yes.
you do,
yes.
you know, is chase your tail,
yeah.
you
yes.
know, when it's all said and done. And it's tough, you know,
yeah.
especially with the stuff as far as in this industry
yes.
and the way that things are.
Especially right now.
Yeah. There is more music available, you know, to everybody at
yes.
one time ever than ever in history.
Yes.
And so... The reason why it's not any different than during the time that you were doing it is because now what do you do
yeah.
in order to be seen?
Yes.
Now what do you do to be noticed?
Yeah.
Now what do you do for
yeah.
somebody to look your
yeah.
way?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's so much noise out there.
How do you
separate yourself?
And how do you?
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? And it's one of those things
well,
where...
Here, I you know, let me just give an example of a way.
Okay.
You know, Johnny Swim.
Yes. I need some of their music.
Yeah, definitely.
I do.
Johnny Swim is about to really blow up.
Nice.
Johnny Swim have been together for 8 years.
Wow.
They have remained true to who they are.
Okay.
Now, you know, my daughter Amanda and Abner Ramirez, they're mm-hmm. married. Mm-hmm. They're great singers and they're great songwriters. Mm. But there's the industry. So, and when I say they've remained true to who they are, this is what I mean. Along the way, because, you know, Amanda Sudano Ramirez now
yes.
is Donna Summer's daughter. There's all these people who show up and want to say, hey, here's this carrot. Hey, here's this shortcut.
Right.
Hey, here's this opportunity to go on The Voice right. or whatever things got side, thrown there.
Sidestep
shortcut to where you want to go.
Right.
They had the integrity and this sense of purpose and commitment and understanding of what their road was and who they are to say no.
Nice.
And so they've been on an 8-year build of where,
good for them,
you know, they would go and work their tails off, go and do whatever they can do wherever they can.
I read something where you made your kids like iron the band's clothes and stuff.
Oh yeah,
like.
they they would come on the road with us, and you know, they would be the assistant, you know, wardrobe person. So they'd have to, you know, press the shirts for the band, you know, put water on the stage, set up the, you know, the quick change booth for their mother. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, they've done every aspect, you know, of the business. So, but you know, the point that I'm trying to make for anybody who's out there is, you know, be true to who you are, you know, try and get an understanding of what your road is. And there are no shortcuts, you know. You know, there are open doors, you know, and when a door opens, walk through the door. Mm. But make sure that that door is your door and not a carrot that is going to pull you away from what your path is.
What your path is and you stuff. Know? And everybody, and see, that's the thing. Everybody wants to hear the easy answer and everybody wants to hear the easy way. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I really strive for, especially when I do the shows and especially around the world, I try to do industry tips and I try to do, you know, things that you can do as far as on your own, obviously, you know, command your destiny, you know, yes. And when you understand your own business, Point taken. I always tell everybody, and my tag is like, you know, your band is your brand and your brand is your business.
Yes.
You know, and yes. So, you know, in thinking like that, why would you give your business to somebody else to hold on to and yes. take care of if you don't know anything about it inside and out?
Yes, that's right.
You know, and so, and it sounds like, you know, with you and with Donna and, you know, and the girls, and, you know, everything you've done is not music based. Everything you've done is pretty much family oriented, family based, you know, integrity rules, you know.
Yes.
And you know, commitments, you know, and things like that, you know, yes. which everybody should uphold and understand no matter what they do.
Yes, exactly.
But you prove
their foundation, their foundational things to right. life.
Yes.
You know, and so.
And ultimately, which, you know, 21st century world.
Yes,
is you're reminding everybody that these ideas.
Yes,
and this.
That's what I'm trying to. I'm trying. That's what I really want to do. You know, and is bring whatever wisdom that I've accumulated, you know, to out. So you get people to start talking about some issues and start a dialogue, have a conversation about these things. And I mean, I don't know everything and I don't, you know, I just have my own truth and you know, but just as a culture, I mean, you know, the divisiveness, you know, that is going on right now, you know, we have much more in common than the things that divide us. Mm. But, you know, we're being driven by networks and ideologies to extremes.
Right.
And, you know, it's a deception, you know, and we as a people, because we are a country of the people, we as a people have to become aware of what's happening and how we're being manipulated and say no. You know, we have to resist this and realize that, look, you can have a different point of view. that's okay.
Well, sure.
You know, let's have a conversation. I can learn something from you, and maybe you can learn something from me, and maybe a greater truth and a greater awareness will come out of that.
Right.
That's what we want, and that's how we succeed, and that's how we grow, and that's how we win.
Perfect. You couldn't say it any better.
Yeah.
That is some fantastic stuff. Songwriting class. So yeah. You decided that you obviously have done a couple of these.
No, I haven't.
No?
This is the first songwriting class I've ever done. I have no idea what I'm going to do.
I've
sort of made a list on my phone while I was bouncing around on the tour bus of like, maybe I could talk about this, or maybe I could bring up this point, or, you know, and you know, I'm probably going to repeat a lot of things that I said here now. But
so this is actually, and for those of you who happen to be in the Memphis area, you know, you probably need to go, because what's really cool is that when you're in this state, it's going to be one of probably the most creative sessions you'll ever have, because this will be the one that you're going to get the cool stuff out of him.
Well, you know, I started my set last night, you know, by saying, you know, I'm so excited to be in Memphis. It is the root of blues and soul and rock and roll, and what a place to be, you know.
Love it. I mean, so for Memphis, I mean, when you think of Memphis, I mean, what comes? I mean, other than the root of rock and roll, and
that's
soul,
that's it. Yeah, I mean, that's what you know. You know. I mean, it's blues and soul and rock and roll. I mean, it's so much history, and you know, I'm a big believer in the spirit of the place.
Yes.
You know, the spirit of the city. You know, it's like, you know, Nashville has that, you know, spirit. You know, Brooklyn has that spirit. Memphis has its own spirit. And Memphis, the spirit of Memphis is heart and soul. Mm-hmm. And it's real. And it's real life. And it's grit. And it's not easy. Mm-hmm. But it's deep.
That's
what I get.
Speaking of which, so the studio that you're sitting in.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Tell me some history.
Yeah, you wanted to hear.
Give me some history, girl.
So you wanted some history. So the studio that you're sitting in was considered, actually it was called Twilight Studios, you know, back in the day. We're talking like 50s, 60s, right?
Mm.
And reason being was that obviously because of where it's located, that it couldn't do, you know, drums, it couldn't record, you know, during the day and stuff because of all the businesses and stuff upstairs. And so Twilight Studios would kick on about 8 o'clock and they would rock out and they would record all throughout into the evening into the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah.
At one point in time, and of course, you know, you got to sit there and remember, you know, we had old blues singers, you had Stax singers. I mean,
yeah.
You had all kinds of people that are in and out here, you know, doing some cool stuff.
Yeah.
One point in time, this was also, it was actually the all of this studio space that you see here also had another side to it, and it was all attached. This used to be Charlie Rich's place. It used to be, it was the Silver Fox's den. And this is, you know, because he lived here in Memphis. And so this was just when, you know, when the wife didn't want him, like, you know, to make racket and noise, this is where he would come hide. It was also where, you know, kept, you know, his tour stuff, you know, when they would go on tour, they would load in and load out from here. They would practice here, and they would do, you know, a lot of cool things here. And
right.
Of course, and you know, you got to figure out all the cats that he had coming in and out,
sure.
You know, during that time, as far as recording and practicing, you know, and things like
sure.
that. Freddie Fender recorded "Wasted Days and Wasted Nights" here. So,
awesome.
Yeah, Brad Dunn, at one point in time, Duck Dunn's nephew, had Leeway Recording Studios. Leeway Recording Studios did a tremendous amount of records, and a tremendous amount of hits, you know, that came out of here. R.L. Burnside, The Wizard, was recorded down in here.
All right. Give me those vibes.
That's what I'm saying.
Take them with me today.
They're here, man.
They're here.
And of course, you know, he had it for quite some time. And Brad was the one who was pretty much, you know, he along with Chris Lee were responsible for kind of building out, you know, this room has a very specific, and that room, the tracking room, has a very specific vibe and a very specific sound.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people come here when they want to have that liveness.
Yeah.
You know,
you can tell it's a very live room.
Yeah, to record in. Shortly after that, Pete Matthews, PM Audio, you know, was located in here. And of course, that was when Brad had left. He restored American Recording Studios here in Memphis.
Wow.
So we work in tandem.
Go Brad.
Yeah, we work in tandem with him. him. Pete Matthews had this for some time. He's a gentleman who founded Evanescence. He works with a lot of cool artists, a lot of cool people that come in and out of here. He wound up getting another facility and working with an individual, and there was like a ton of different engineers that were trying to beat down to get this, because this is like a holy grail spot. A lot of people don't know that. And we were afforded this opportunity because Radio Memphis had to live.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, and we're happy to have you here. Are you kidding? It's been one of the things for us is to be inspiring to the up and coming generation. Yes. My biggest thing also too is like I was telling you when we were on break, that they have to understand what they have to do. They have to understand that this is hard. But they also have to understand the integrity, and they have to understand as far as the quality of what you put out there, and am I going to, and this is my thing, am I going to listen to this song, and am I going to be standing in the kitchen in my boxer shorts and in rollers and still singing 20 years from now?
You know
what I mean?
Yes.
I have to say, it was probably about 2 years ago, I was in LA. Yeah, I was doing some stuff for NAMM, and I was doing some stuff for whatever. I was hanging out with a bunch of metal bands. Okay, yeah. I also do a metal show, and they're different. We're talking alternative. You're talking prog. You're talking hardcore. And these guys all look the part.
Yeah.
And so and we're all crashed out. At this one place. Because this particular individual was where we were all doing these projects and stuff together that we were working on all that week. Uh-huh. And I got up the next morning, and so there's 20 metalheads in the kitchen, all right? They're making pancakes, they're making coffee, and they're making stuff. And what are they singing? They're singing Stax.
Yeah.
They're singing Memphis.
Yeah.
They're singing, Al Green.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, that lady that just popped in her head, she'll come back in. I need to introduce you to her, Tony Green. She started out as a backup singer for Al.
I'm so tired of being alone. I'm so tired of on my own. Would you help me, girl?
Sing it to me. See? So, and for us, Memphis has got such a, such a heart, and Memphis has got, they breed talent here.
Yeah.
They breed
it's the spirit of the city.
They breed talent here, and I love watching artists that come through, whether they're brand new or well known. They come here. It's like they touch Beale Street like it's the yellow brick road.
Yes.
Like they if they get it on them, if they touch the river, if they get the mud on them and stuff, that they're gonna come. They're gonna leave here with a I've been anointed.
Yes.
And I'm gonna have that soul, and I'm gonna have that grit, and I'm gonna have that deepness.
Yeah.
Hey,
can I just let me say this other thing. I had the most amazing experience yesterday.
What'd you do?
I went to the St. Jude's Research Hospital.
Good for you.
Which is I think it's the most beautiful place in the world.
Isn't that the crazy coolest place?
I think that if the whole world was set up like St. Jude's Research Hospital, it would be the most beautiful place that could ever be.
Isn't that crazy?
What a beautiful place. Mm. What a place of heart and compassion and joy and color and hope and inspiration. I mean, I was just so taken by it. And
hopefully we'll write a song about it.
Yay Memphis. Yay Memphis.
I love it. I love it. Well, hopefully you'll find yourself back in Memphis, and this isn't like
I'm coming back to Memphis. I'm going to do some shows, and I'll come visit you again, because
you got to,
because I made a friend today.
You did. I made a super friend today. Are you kidding? I also have your number now, so I'm going to be calling you up and bugging your ear, because again, you're a Pandora's box. And there's secrets and there's secrets that are locked up in your head.
Yes.
And those secrets are not, they're not rules. They're not lessons.
No.
Your secrets are stories.
Yeah.
And when you share those stories, somebody like me, it's like, okay, what was going on during this time period, and what were you doing? You've given me the sense of hope.
Yes.
You've given me the sense that, if you do the right thing.
Yes.
And if you do what you're supposed to do, and you have the right heart,
and
you put it all in the right place, that
you
do get the good pieces.
Yes.
You do, Dave.
Amen.
Absolutely. So I know that we're going to have to get out of here, because you're going to have to make your way over to your...
Yeah.
I cannot believe. I thought you'd been doing this for a minute. This is your first time running class.
No.
What inspired you to do it?
somebody, you know, Fiona said, would you do this? You're going to be in Memphis. Would you do this?
Oh, I was like, shout out to Fiona. She's been fantastic.
You know, okay, I'll do it. I mean, and honestly, I mean, you know, there's been a lot going on. When you're on the road, you know, you're not really thinking, you know, but it's actually something that secretly I've always really wanted to do.
I'm so glad that, there's your sign.
Yeah. So yeah. So, you know, and like I said, you know, the door opens and you walk through it. So we'll see what happens today. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Okay. So this is my thing about the whole deal as far as songwriters. 70s and 80s. You like, and I did this, and I've talked about this before. It was like over the holidays and stuff, and everybody was popping up songs, and it was like some challenge on videos and stuff. And so instead of just, you know, popping up, you know, the songs, you know, that you liked and you thought were really cool, I was putting up like a little lesson to go with it. Like, hey, did you know that this song was number one on Billboard, this whatever, uh-huh. and their background or who was writing or who played. You know, I was doing that stuff, right? Uh-huh. It's because, you know, we're nerds.
That's good. No, that's so much of that gets lost. That's the other thing. The liner note thing.
And that was my deal. Well, what was so funny was that, you know, I started realizing that X amount of songs, you know, out of the handful, there were only like really four major songwriters that were responsible for all of it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right,
and so it sat there and it was like, you know, you got to understand that there were particular bands and there were particular groups that were, you know, that were noticed and they were doing really good. But once somebody had gotten a hold of them and then somebody had actually placed a certain song for them, you know, for them,
yes.
it wound up catapulting their careers.
Yes.
And it was one of those, it was a real finite lesson for me, mm-hmm. you know, in understanding, you know, one of the other things is that there's so many talented people, there's so many talented artists that, you know, there's something there for them. But you got somebody like you that comes along and goes, hey, this is for you.
Yes.
I believe this one belongs to you.
Yeah. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And even though you wrote it, but if they sing it and they perform it, yes. you know, it's a beautiful relationship.
Exactly.
And that in and of itself, you know, is something that it's opened my eyes so big, especially, and I don't know what it is for me about this year for songwriters, because I guess it's been about a month or two. I talked to Judy Stocky and spent some time with her, you know, on air and stuff. And, you know, and she's straightforward like you, man. I mean, she's like, you know, kind of, you know, but very, very, you know, very, very focused and very intuitive and very, you know, involved as far as her thought processes. And one of the things was that it's okay for somebody to come in and go, hey, here's a song. You know, it's not I'm not saying that you suck. I'm not saying that you can't write. I'm saying,
right.
But I'm trying to open you up. I'm trying to show you that here's a side of you that you didn't know existed.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And when that right marriage happens, it's magic, you know, that's the business we're in. We're in the magic business.
That's the business.
You know,
I'm just thrilled that you decided the first time you're going to do one is in Memphis. There's a sign there.
Yes. Amen.
There's a sign there.
I'm excited. I'm nervous.
You're going to be fine.
And that's all a good thing. You know, nervousness is a good thing. You know, it puts you on point. So let's see what happens.
Well, for those of you, if you happen to be in the Memphis area, you can actually catch up with Mr. Bruce Sedano. He is doing a master songwriting class. Look, this is the one time, you know, because obviously he's going to probably do more after this, but this is the one you don't want to miss because you're going to get him full-fledged.
I'm a virgin.
He's emotion and everything, man. He's going to lay it all out there for you, and you're probably going to get all the good stuff. So don't miss that. His actual class is starting at noon today right here in Memphis over at the Stax Academy and stuff, and so we're going to make sure that he gets on his way. Now, 21st Century World, that comes out, you know, May 5th, and of course we've been spinning a couple of tracks for you right here on Radio Memphis. You guys, now where, if everybody were to look for you and look for your stuff, where are they going to go?
All the obvious all the obvious characters, iTunes and Amazon, and there you go,
and they can catch up with you on that.
Yes.
All right, we're friends now.
We're friends. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Diane.
We're friends. So you're going to call in, you're going to hang out, and then you're going to come back to Memphis.
Yes.
And there's a sign here. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
There's a sign here.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. How about a little common sense to get us on out of the door?
Beautiful. It's the centerpiece song of the record. It's what I call the centerpiece song of the record.
The centerpiece song. That's, well, I'm going to tell you what. Everybody can use a little common sense because that's what's going to get you through. Amen. All right. Guys, thank you so much, Bruce Sedona. We love having you here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
Man.
You guys, this is a very special Radio Memphis weekend. Of course, you just heard Bruce Sedona right here on Radio Memphis.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved, and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.